Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. Another week, really, where impeachment dominated a lot of the national discourse. This week, we went from the Intelligence Committee to the Judiciary Committee. And joining us this week, one of the members of that Judiciary Committee, Congresswoman Karen Bass, who's also the chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus. One of the members of that caucus, Kamala Harris, dropped out this week. The California senator, there's so much promise at the beginning of her campaign. We're talking about that this week. We're talking about a new entrant into the race, Deval Patrick, joining us in studio this week to talk about how he thinks he's going to be able to pull this off. We also have a husband and wife duo who often disagree with each other, John Cobalt, Deborah Cobalt. John, of course, you know from KFI's John and Ken show. Deborah, you know, as a journalist and a podcaster. Both have been on our show frequently, but never been on together. So we're going to get to their debate in a little bit. But let's begin with Karen Bass, the congresswoman from Los Angeles, with the discussion about impeachment, about a little bit about Kamala Harris, and a little bit about some other issues as well. But we start on the issue of impeachment. Here she is.
Congresswoman Bass, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
What was the most important thing you learned this week?
Well, the most important thing I learned was about our history, about what our framers were thinking. Number one, why they came up with impeachment, period, and when they saw it being needed. And after listening to the scholars yesterday, it to me is very, very clear that we are facing a grave situation in our country, and we absolutely need to move to develop articles of impeachment.
So you're ready to vote to impeach the president?
I am ready to vote to impeach the president.
You know, on the other side, the Republicans brought this witness named Jonathan Turley, well-known law professor. He says that there's not enough proof and that this process is being rushed. Here's what he had to say.
This isn't improvisational jazz. Close enough is not good enough. If you're going to accuse a president of bribery, you need to make it stick.
So what do you say to that?
Well, you know what? I was actually surprised that he was the Republican witness because I thought that he made a very, very weak case. He, in fact, said that he wasn't saying the president shouldn't be impeached. He just thought we needed more information. But one of the reasons why we will move to impeach the president is because he is obstructing everything. He is obstructing Congress. He won't allow witnesses to come forward. He won't allow information to come forward. And he is putting everything through the courts, knowing good and well that we have no idea how long it will take. And I think all of us feel an incredible sense of urgency that the reason why we need to move to impeach him and need to impeach him now is because he is intervening in the next election. The Mueller report talked about the past. Ukraine is about what is happening right now. And it's bad enough that we have to worry about the Russians intervening in our next election. We cannot tolerate the president of the United States trying to throw the election his way.
Do you realistically think that 20 Republicans are going to vote to convict and remove him in the Senate?
Well, you know what? There is one scenario that I think it's possible. Actually, there's two scenarios. One scenario is there is a parliamentary maneuver that could take place that could allow for a secret ballot. If there was a secret ballot, Jeff Flake, former senator, said he thought there'd be over 30 senators that would vote to impeach. Because one thing that we all know here on the Hill is that when we talk to our Republican colleagues, when they're not in front of cameras or in front of microphones, they understand his behavior is unacceptable, inappropriate, and I frankly think they would be relieved if he was off the stage, because on a daily basis they have to account for this guy. They have to answer for his inappropriate tweets and his inappropriate behavior.
Well, assuming that Mitch McConnell doesn't put forth a secret ballot in this situation, most likely the president won't be convicted in the Senate. And there's some that say that this could is all kind of a bit of a show. But at the same time, why not deal with issues like homelessness, issues like the USMCA trade deal? That's what the president's suggesting, that there's better use of time.
And let me just tell you something. I think that's so ironic because you know that we have passed over 400 pieces of legislation. Many of them, not all of them, but many of them have been bipartisan legislation. And it's Mitch McConnell who refuses to raise them in the Senate. And so we have been doing plenty of work. But if the Senate will not put it up for a vote, then it's really in their lap. It's not that we haven't been doing work. But I will tell you that, again, the reason why I think think it's so important is because I do not want to see him interfere in the next election. Now, let's just say it goes exactly as you say. Nothing happens in the Senate and he gets exonerated. I do think we will have put some brakes on his behavior. But there is one other scenario that I could see taking place that might lead to the Senate to change their mind and maybe go for a secret ballot. We can't trust his behavior. We don't know what he is going to do. For example, his erratic decision to withdraw troops from Syria that essentially allowed the slaughter of over 300 Kurds. That's 300 people that were killed because of his spontaneous, erratic decision. It led to the release of God knows how many ISIS fighters. So if he makes an irrational policy decision foreign policy decision, because he's backed against the corner, my Republican colleagues might decide, like I believe, that he's a clear and present danger to our country and must be stopped.
That would be something. All right, so let's talk for a moment, though, about where people are at. Most polls show that most Californians do want there to be impeachment. Although most polls also show that people are more concerned about issues like health care and some other issues as well. You just did a big telephone town hall with over 1,000 constituents. What are you hearing from people?
Yeah. Well, first of all, that town hall was specifically about impeachment. What I did was I like to do town halls before we're going to do something as opposed to after, because I wanted my constituents to understand what the hearing that happened yesterday was going to be about. But you know me, Alec, I have town halls all the time, and people in my district are concerned about prescription drug prices. You know, everyone in LA is concerned about the homeless crisis. And so we are working on those issues. We do have legislation to reduce the prescription drug crisis. Congresswoman Maxine Waters has a huge piece of legislation to address homelessness. And again, we are in the majority. We can pass legislation out of this House, but Mitch McConnell needs to do something in the Senate. I think the only thing he thinks is important right now is to fill the courts up with numerous right-wing judges. That's really the only thing they've been doing in the Senate is confirming judges.
Yeah, some 182 judges that have been confirmed during the Trump administration.
And that's a scary notion.
Let's talk for another thing that you're very passionate about is Africa. You're one of the leaders in the House on that issue. You recently brought a group of fellow members to the border to talk about the migration issue and how some Africans are being caught up in sort of bureaucratic limbo. Explain what you saw, what you learned.
Sure, all of us understand what's happening on the border, but there is a population that I think has been invisible, and that are African migrants and migrants from the Caribbean, and they are essentially rendered stateless because one of the things that the president has done with his bullying behavior toward foreign policy is he's bullied countries to keep people in Mexico, not allow them to cross the border, breaking international treaties, breaking international precedent. People have a right around the world that if they feel threatened, that they can show up on a border, and it's up to them to make the case that they deserve asylum. Since he is forcing Mexico to keep people in Mexico, you have African migrants who do not speak Spanish, they speak English and French, who are essentially stuck. And so I took members of the Congressional Black Caucus and members of my subcommittee to Tijuana to meet with the migrants, to hear their stories. And then we came on the other side of the border in San Ysidro, and we had a hearing because, in my opinion, the crisis at the border is a humanitarian crisis, but is being dealt with like a law enforcement problem. And that is because there is a white supremacist named Stephen Miller who is in charge of immigration policy in the White House. And I'm sad to say that he is from liberal Santa Monica. So how liberal Santa Monica raised a white supremacist and then he wound up as a special advisor to the president is anybody's guess. Another example of why this administration is so dangerous.
Let's talk about another issue. You are the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. One of the members of your caucus, Kamala Harris, dropped out of the presidential race this week. Another member of your caucus, Cory Booker, has said that there's now more billionaires in the race than black people, suggesting that he may not even make it onto the stage for the next debate. And what started as a really diverse group of potential candidates is now down to a whole lot of white people, frankly. Are you concerned? Yeah. Are you concerned about that? And if so, is there anything that should be done about that?
Well, frankly, I hated to see our senator drop out because I thought that she did a wonderful job. She made us all proud. And frankly, she made history and she broke a glass ceiling because she certainly showed that an African-American woman can be a viable, strong candidate. But at the end of the day, it takes money. Now, one of these days, I hope we can get money out of politics. I want you to know it was one of the first bills we voted for when we took over that's languishing in the Senate. But until that happens, it is all about the dollars. And so I certainly hope that Cory qualifies. I don't want to see a stage of only white candidates representing the Democratic Party, especially considering our diversity. But it is what it is. And until we are able to change things in this country, you know, that's the way it is in terms of money. But I will tell you, regardless of who the Democratic nominee is, I guarantee you that we are all going to wrap our arms around that person and make sure that if we are not able to get rid of this president through the impeachment process, that November will be the end of his presidency.
Well, Congresswoman, we always appreciate you sharing your views. We want to point out that we reached out to the White House inviting them to share their views, and they say that they hope to have a representative on the show soon. And, you know,
yeah,
we like to play.
Don't hold your breath.
Our thanks to Congresswoman Bass. Next up is Deval Patrick. He is a two-term governor of Massachusetts, started off really with nothing on the south side of Chicago, single mom living with welfare, didn't have much of a relationship with his father, Pat Patrick, a great jazz musician, and turned into the first black governor in the history of his state. He's kind of an extraordinary life story, coming into this presidential race pretty late, trying to make a name for himself, and he's out here talking to us. Here's the conversation.
Governor Patrick, welcome to The Issue
Is. It's good to be with you. Nice. Thank you for having me,
nice
Alex.
Nice to have you here. Thank you so much for being here. So you are.
Thanks for the walk-on music.
Yes, and so that's the Massachusetts song. You actually spent time living here in California.
I did.
And met your wife here in California as well.
I did indeed. That's right. Back in 1982, I came out to clerk for a year on the Ninth Circuit for Steve Reinhardt. Yeah. And I met my wife then, and I was on my way to San Francisco, as a matter of fact, to join a firm. And she was asked by the firm she was working for here, having gone to law school and started her practice here in Los Angeles, to move back home for her to New York and help them start their office there. So we decided in the course of that year we wanted to be together, and off we went.
So California's been pretty good to you.
It's been very good. 35 years we've been married this year.
All right, so the presidential campaign, a lot of people, when you look at the polls, say that they're satisfied with the candidates that were there.
Mm.
You're still jumping into the race.
Yes.
What are you not satisfied with? What's the hole? What's missing from the field that you're going to provide?
It's a question I get a lot, but I would just say, first of all, that we were ready to go a little bit more than a year ago, ready to step out. And about 3 weeks before Thanksgiving, Alex, my wife was diagnosed with uterine cancer. Mm. And it's the sort of thing that just brings your feet back to ground. And I think we did the right thing by paying attention to that and to her. When we celebrated our 35th wedding anniversary in May, she's cancer-free.
Congratulations.
Yes, it's such a blessing. And she's continued to be interested and committed, and we've continued to get encouragement from so many folks, known and unknown. I think when the total stranger reaches out and says, I wish we were in the field, it has a particular impact. I'll also say that having been in New Hampshire and Iowa and Nevada and South Carolina and back again, it is true the other candidates have been out for a while and spent a lot of money and a lot of time, but it is by no means settled.
Yeah, high undecided. So what is your lane? What is the pitch? Why you over everybody else?
Well, look, we are at a moment where we need big responses to big challenges, chronic issues around, we were talking earlier about homelessness, around the cost of health care and the availability of it, around, frankly, an economy that grows out or needs to grow out to the middle and the marginalized and not just up to the well-connected. And solutions to those kinds of big challenges require that we build bridges. And that's what I've been about. You know, a life of life and work experience that ranges from poverty on the south side of Chicago, where I grew up, through college and law school, and then in and out of the public and private sectors, solving problems here and abroad.
Do you wish you got in earlier?
I wish that my wife had never had cancer. Yeah. I guess is the answer. And there's really no way around that. Frankly, if I thought it had been settled by the time we were ready, I wouldn't have come in.
Let's talk about some of the issues. The biggest debate that we've seen on the debate stage on the Democratic side mm-hmm. has been over the issue of health care. And yes. when you were Massachusetts governor, you helped to implement the system that really became the model for Obamacare yes. around the country. Right. Some Democrats say we need to go farther. We mm-hmm. need Medicare for all. Mm-hmm. What say you?
Well, I think it's interesting. We talk about Medicare for all. It's become a slogan for a lot of different ideas. 4 or 6% of the people in Massachusetts have health insurance today without Medicare for all. I still don't think there's another state that has gotten that far. Access is a big challenge, and it's a continuing challenge. I think at the federal level, rather than go to Medicare for all, I'd rather see a public option. Mm-hmm. And that public option could well be Medicare. But there is some value in having the tension that comes from government and the private sector trying to solve a similar problem. And I think what we would get from having a public option alongside private insurance is that the private insurance market would start to think of ways to get to offer a low-cost competitive option. And frankly, Medicare or whatever the public option would think of ways to innovate to make that care better. And I think that's what you have to do to iterate toward the right solution.
The issue that Californians seem to care about most right now is the issue of homelessness. Yes. We've got a crisis in this state.
Yes.
What is the federal government's role in solving that? And yeah. if you were president, what would that look like?
It's not one thing, at least in our experience back home in Massachusetts. We did something with a new tool called a social impact bond, which is a public-private collaboration on how to experiment with different solutions without putting public money at jeopardy. So you then have a proof point you can show to the legislature. And we did one in homelessness. It was, in this case, chronic individual homelessness. Family homelessness is a different kind of challenge. And we are on the path of eliminating individual homelessness in Massachusetts. It's never one thing. It's shelter, yes. But it's also dealing with the compounding issues. You know, there are sometimes mental health issues, there are substance abuse issues, there's questions about readiness to join the mainstream workforce in terms of, you know, preparation of skills and mm-hmm. a place for him or her when they are prepared. And I think without the wraparound services, some of which, by the way, in our case, were supported by federal subsidies, shelter alone, in many cases, is not going to be enough.
Let's get to know you a bit, right? Because I think there are a lot of people who maybe are unfamiliar with your story, mm-hmm. and it's quite a story. You come largely from a single mom, didn't right. have a super close relationship with your dad growing up. Your dad, a great jazz musician. Right. South side of Chicago, work your way through Harvard, mm-hmm. Harvard, and to the sort of upper echelons of American society, kind mm-hmm. of. So what do you want people to know about your story, and so what are the most important lessons we can learn from your example?
Yeah, well, you're right. I did grow up much of that time on welfare on the south side of Chicago. And my mother and sister and I shared one of two bedrooms in our grandparents' two-bedroom tenement. And we had a set of bunk beds. So you go from the top bunk to the bottom bunk to the floor every third night on the floor. I went to big, crowded, under-resourced, sometimes violent public schools, but we had a very strong sense of community because mm-hmm. that was a time when every child was under the jurisdiction of every adult on the block. And I think that notion that you have a stake in your neighbor's dreams and struggles as well as your own has been one of the key lessons I've carried with me through my educational and professional life, my personal life for that matter. And another lesson I think we got was, you got it too, we all do from our grandparents, this notion that we're supposed to do in our time what we can to leave things better for those who come behind us, that notion of generational responsibility. And I think those two issues are the reason I have brought a reform-minded approach to every assignment I've ever had and why I've never been willing to leave my conscience at the door.
What would that young Duvall, who slept in the bunk bed, think of Duvall today?
He'd probably say, I'll tell you the voice of my grandmother I hear, which is, look at you now. But, you know, it's not that I always wanted to be president. Yeah. It's the same way I didn't always want to be a governor. That was the only thing I've run for. It's that it felt like there was a moment where I had a contribution to make that could leave things better. And if we can make of our national politics what we try to do in Massachusetts, which is about everyone everywhere, and not just the folks who are, you know, on your side, but and a humility and a confidence, frankly, being willing to listen to others who have different points of view, we can actually make some progress, and we need some progress.
You know, you've largely blazed a trail as an African-American man. I know you have a close relationship with the former President Barack Obama, who also blazed a trail.
Indeed.
Recently, we saw Kamala Harris drop out of the race, and Cory Booker has talked about the fact that we have more billionaires than black people in this race going forward. Do you think that's an issue? Do you think that that the Democratic Party candidates right now are maybe too white when it comes to the debate stage?
Well, it's a tough question in the sense that there are these qualifying standards that the National Party has put in place in order to get on the debate stage. I will say that the diversity of the field is incredibly exciting. It's a different field without Kamala Harris, who is an extraordinary public figure, and I hope that and trust that she will continue to contribute in public life. The debate stage itself, I mean, I don't know if you've watched the debates.
Every single one. covered every moment.
I have too. And, you know, the things you have to do to qualify make perfect sense to me. But actually, the debates themselves in terms of format as a way to get to inform the public about where you are and how you think, I'm not sure they've been as helpful as one would like.
So you have not qualified for the next debate, which is here in California. It's hard coming in late because of all the rules to qualify for one of these debates. You also don't have $52 billion like Mike Bloomberg, who seems to air every other TV ad right now on TV.
Yeah.
How do you do this? Yeah. How do you pull this off, coming in late without that kind of money?
Well, so you make it, in my view, not about me, but about us. You turn the campaign over to your supporters, and you ask them to make it personal. We were talking before going on air about how we had volunteers from every single state in America within sign up on the website DevalPatrick2020.com within 2 or 3 hours of going live on the day I announced. We had those and many more on a conference call the other day, just to tell them about progress and where I am and where we're going, and to ask them what they needed to spread the word and make it personal. And I think that notion of sort of relational organizing, not just geographical, but relational, and making it plain that the campaign and, if I'm elected, my presidency will be about everyone everywhere. Because that it not being that way is one of the reasons I think people feel so alienated from their government today.
It's also fun, though, to get to know about you a little bit.
Oh, here
we have
comes.
A game called Personal Issues.
Yes.
This is where we put 30 seconds up on the clock.
Okay.
And we get to know a little bit about you.
Do
with
I get
some,
to see
with
the
some
clock
rapid,
around here
rapid fire questions. No, it'll be obvious. You'll hear it. You'll hear a ding when it's over.
Okay.
All right. Here we go. Who's your favorite actor or actress?
Wow. Probably Angela Bassett.
Oh.
On the actress
we love
side.
Her. She's on Fox.
Yeah.
Favorite meal?
Ooh. Roast chicken.
Favorite athlete of all time?
Probably, runner Jesse Owens, that's it.
Favorite TV show?
Right now, Black Sails.
Okay.
Have you seen it?
No, I have not.
It's really good.
Dream vacation spot?
There is a remote part of New Zealand that my wife and I have visited a couple of times, which is pretty special.
Wow, and last question, who's your role model?
I have a bunch, but I would say that the person who has had, I mean, there really are a lot, and I've been blessed that way. Mm-hmm. But the person who maybe has had the most profound, lasting impact on me was my sixth grade teacher, who in that very crowded classroom taught us to count and say the greetings in German, you know, took us to the first opera I'd ever been to. I didn't know what they were singing about. I still don't. I love it today. she took us to a new movie out at the time, LX, called The Sound of Music, and she used it to teaches about the rise of the Nazis in the Second World War. The first person I remember to really help me imagine, all of us, what it might be like to be a citizen of the world, which is a gift for any kid, I think, but especially a kid from the South Side of Chicago in those days. And she was present when I graduated from college and law school, when I was married, when I was sworn in at the Justice Department. And she would have been president at my, inauguration for governor had she lived. But my third grade teacher was there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that shows long-lasting relationships.
Indeed.
Nice
Indeed.
To have you here. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to Governor Patrick. Next up, Deborah John Cobalt. Two of our favorite guests who have both been on many of our panels separate from each other. Now the husband and wife team coming together. They often disagree with each other politically, kind of like a James Carville, Mary Matlin kind of thing. They've wanted to debate each other on the show for a while, so we're finally making that happen. John, of course, the longtime host of John and Ken on KFI AM 640 here in Southern California, one of the most successful shows in the history of Southern California. Deborah, we used to be a reporter on many different stations, including Fox 11, and now she's a podcaster, host of Deborah Cobalt Live. So here they are. We start on the issue of impeachment.
What do you make of this week? Is this a worthy exercise? Are you glad we're having these hearings in the first place?
It's preposterous. First of all, they made the case weeks ago. Yeah, he was finagling trying to get Ukraine to investigate the Bidens because it would help him. I think people figured that out, you know, in about 20 minutes. But then it goes on and it goes on and it goes on. And I just don't think the majority of the country looks at it as this big felony crime.
I think it's important because if someone's doing wrong, they need to be, you know, held up to a standard. However, I do think that it's a bit of a show from the left, and I think at the end it's going to come back and bite them. So
then what do you do, though, if you're the left? I mean, they would say, look, we're being forced into this. The president's the one who committed what they see as crimes, that he's corrupt, and you got to do something to check him.
I don't think any of these people would carry on like this if it was a Democratic president who'd been caught doing it.
Of course.
I mean, really, it's similar to the Clinton situation in that, yes, we knew that he perjured himself. He lied under oath over the Monica Lewinsky case. But none of the Democrats thought it was important. They said, oh, it's just a private sexual affair. All right, we shouldn't criminalize that. This is similar. It's a parking ticket situation. And they want to give him a life sentence in prison.
A parking ticket situation?
Yeah.
I don't think so. It's more serious than that. However, I think this is going to end up something that, in the end, will come back to not be very favorable for the Democratic Party. But it's not a parking ticket. Come on.
Nothing happened, though. They didn't withhold the aid, and they didn't do the investigation. It was Trump blustering on a phone call, mostly.
Is nothing happened because he was caught? I mean, he ended up giving up the aid after he knew about the whistleblower report.
Right, but it's still nothing happened, ultimately. So, I mean, there really should be an actual crime committed, not somebody was pushing to do something that was over the line, not something who thought about it, he was shouting orders. There really has to be something that happened that you could point to the body and say, look at that. Somebody did that.
Isn't attempted murder also a crime?
I'm with you, Alex. You can't just let something like this go. Again, if you just look back at the Constitution, and that way I did agree with Pelosi, you have to go through the process. I just think that this is going to take us all the way to the election, and then there's so much that's not being addressed in this country, and I heard you talking about it earlier.
Yeah.
Homelessness, so much more. Women's rights. And we're going to go another 9 months with this, although I know that they want to really speed everything up. But
I think to have an impeachment, you have to have most of the country saying what happened was really awful here. This is like the way with Nixon, where they had tapes where he was clearly covering up the Watergate burglary. That was a slap in the face, and everybody said, oh, my God, that's really bad. You don't have that here.
But no, you do, though. But, I mean, polls show that a majority of the country, one, favors impeachment, and a much bigger majority believes that what he did was wrong. I mean, close to 70% of people believe
doing
that what he did
is wrong. Doing
something wrong
is different than doing something that requires removal from office. Mm-hmm. I really think that should be reserved for the most egregious cases. Mm-hmm. And here it's just more of a gray area in terms of severity.
So then, Deborah, what is the the Democrats to do, because what they would argue is that the constitutional remedy, the Constitution actually mentions impeachment. It doesn't mention anything else, doesn't mention censure or anything else like that. What do you think is the remedy? What should be the slap on the wrist?
I think at this point that they've gone this far. They've got to see it all the way through. I do. And I also agree with you. You can't just let something like this go, because the next step would be that he would act on it. So that kind of behavior.
Then I would say it would be more legitimate.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I can't imagine what's gone on in private phone conversations between world leaders over the years. I think if we could know what they all said, everybody would have gotten impeached and removed. Mm. I think there's kind of a real-world aspect to this, and people want to get all pompous, like some of the Congress and the senators, about this is a grave threat to the American Constitution. It's like, no, it's not. Okay, this is ordinary daily business. Every time we give aid to a country, there's a favor in return.
Do you think if it was reversed and there was a Democratic president who did this, that Republicans would be upset about it?
Yes. They'd be blowing it out of proportion. They tried to blow a lot of Obama's situations way out of proportion. That's why I lose interest in this stuff. There's no consistency. It's a lot of hypocrisy. And you're not going to get 20 Republican senators anyway. So in the end, this is a campaign tactic. And they're what because they don't want to talk about the 3.5% unemployment, the record high stock market, the tax cuts that has energized the economy. Wages are up 3% this month. They don't want to talk about that. They can't run on that.
Deborah, last word to you. Why is your husband wrong?
Those unemployment numbers also include part-time workers, so you have to remember that. And why are you wrong? You have to hold our leaders accountable. I also agree with you, though, that this is a bit of a staging. And I also say that this is just going to come back. And for them, I don't know how well they're going to do in the election.
And we're going to continue our conversation with John and Deborah. Let's switch things up and talk about Kamala Harris and her campaign that collapsed this week. Started with 20,000 people in Oakland, all this promise, top-tier candidate, had that big debate moment with Joe Biden. It's been all downhill from there. She ends up dropping out before a vote is even cast. Here are John and Deborah on Kamala.
I think people had the chance to really take a better look at her, and I don't like the way she conducted herself, and I think she just, people lost interest in her.
What do you make of?
Plus, she flip-flops.
It's weird for me because I do like what Trump is doing. So I don't look at the Democratic candidates as who would I like for president. I look at him, it's like, who could do damage against him? Who could run a good campaign? And when she first came out, I thought, oh, she could be tough because she's a prosecutor. She's really smart. You know, she can interrogate very well the way a prosecutor does. But then what really shocked me is she had no convictions on anything. When she went after Biden on the busing, 2 days later, she admitted she doesn't think busing is really that good an idea, which means you just did that to embarrass the old guy.
Right.
It wasn't sincere.
And she raised her hand for Medicare for All.
That's
and then
right.
Put her hand down.
Put her hand down. Yeah. And then she said, I'm against Bernie Sanders' plan. And somebody said, well, wait, you co-sponsored his bill. And so it was a flip-flop.
So I guess the question is, where do we go from here? She had most elected officials in California endorsing her. Now we have the California primary coming up. Bernie Sanders in a poll this week ahead in the LA Times poll for the first time in California. How do you see this impacting our state here?
It wouldn't surprise me if he won. There are so many progressive voters so energized in California that he just may get a huge turnout because he's the farthest left of them all. And he gets a huge Hispanic vote, too.
Yeah.
What about Elizabeth Warren, though? What are your thoughts on her? I think people would warm to her in our country, in our state now.
Although her poll numbers are down everywhere across the country.
I know,
across
but
the country
I'm talking
in the last
California
few weeks.
Here.
Yeah.
You know what Bernie's strength is, and which is why he's doing better than Elizabeth Warren here and better than Kamala Harris, is he's been flat out honest about his insanity right from the beginning. He goes out and says, you know what, this is going to be $50 trillion in taxes. Yes, the government's going to completely run the healthcare system. Elizabeth Warren kind of dances around, and for weeks and weeks, she wouldn't say how much it was going to cost. And Kamala Harris kept changing her mind. He's so authentic that even though he's nuts, people appreciate it. I know what I'm getting here.
So you said you're concerned, you're looking at who could be the toughest for Trump. Who do you think's the toughest for Trump?
I think Pete Buttigieg would really be hard for Trump to run against.
Why is that?
Because he wouldn't take the bait. He'd keep his cool. He'd stay calm. He'd always be on point and intelligent and not crazy. He wants to do incremental changes. It's a tough target. You know, Biden's an easy target. Warren's an easy target. Buttigieg would do a rope-a-dope on Trump.
What do you think, Deborah?
I think it would be Biden. because people know Biden. And I happen to like Buttigieg very, very much, and I align myself the most with his politics, but I think Biden would be the one to be more difficult for Trump.
Well, we'll see. We've got, of course, a debate coming in a few weeks here in California, which is going to be pretty exciting to have all of them here. All right, we've talked a lot about politics, but what I think is really interesting about you two is that you often disagree politically, yet you have a happy marriage, or at least you seem to.
Wait a minute.
How
do you pull that off in this era of polarization?
It's difficult, don't you think? I mean, we bike a lot, and usually I will bring up politics quite often, and he's like, no, we can't do this
I can't do a show all day and night. Really, sometimes I feel like I got a second show when I come home at the dinner table. I've really drawn the line of the bike rides.
Yeah,
because otherwise you'll see us going up and down the bike path in Santa Monica just shouting at each other. And I said, this has got to be the break.
Well,
here.
That doesn't happen. I'll just go ahead of you.
Yeah. One of the storms off on the other
bike.
No,
but it's not easy. And then as you mentioned, we have three boys, and they pretty much align more with me. So you can see how this goes at home, and you should see the dinner table when no one's watching. It's quite animated.
Well, we are excited to have you, and we're grateful for all that you guys have done for our show.
All right. Hopefully, I can have a relationship just like John and Deborah. It is fun to be able to respectfully disagree. Want to make a big announcement? Our show is expanding. We're very excited about this. Of course, right now you can watch us in Los Angeles and San Francisco on TV. Of course, listen to the podcast anywhere. But next week, we're going to be launching in San Diego on TV on Fox 5 in San Diego. We're going to be airing on Sunday nights at 11:30 p.m. there. We're excited to have them along. America's Finest City, used to work there. Love San Diego. It's one of the best places there is. So we are going to be on there. And in the new year, we're going to be expanding to even more markets, which we're exciting to announce in a couple weeks. So thank you for watching The Issue Is. Thank you for listening to The Issue Is. Please tell people about The Issue Is. We really appreciate it. Please connect with me in social media at Alex Michelson. I look forward to it. And please leave us a review. That's it for this week. We'll see you next time for more of The Issue Is.